Henry Dreyfuss was a leader of the first generation of industrial designers. He and his team were responsible for the design of some of the most ubiquitous and iconic products of the mid-20th century: the Bell Model 500 telephone, the Honeywell Round thermostat, and the Polaroid Automatic 100 land camera, among many other products and services. Similar to how George Washington established precedents for the American presidency, Dreyfuss was a founding father of American industrial design. He defined expectations for the role of the designer and their relationship to engineering and marketing, the balance between commercial objectives and human needs, and the philosophy of design not as a stylistic afterthought, but as an integral part of creating classic products that stand the test of time. In his book, The Man in the Brown Suit, Russell Flincham draws on a wealth of primary sources to explore how Dreyfuss transitioned from a theater designer in the 1920s to one of the big four industrial designers during the so-called golden age of industrial design. This monograph, which is a detailed study on a specialized subject, accompanied a 1997 exhibition of Dreyfuss's work at the Cooper Hewitt National Design Museum, where Flincham was a fellow. From the 1920s through the 60s, Flincham covers how Dreyfuss's work evolved and his influence grew while staying committed to the 5 points that outlined his design philosophy: safety and convenience of use, ease of maintenance, cost, appeal, and appearance, importantly in that order. Referred to as both the dean and the conscience of the field, he was considered by his friends, family, and colleagues, above all, a person of integrity. As a user experience designer working on enterprise software products today, I think we can learn from how Dreyfuss championed human values during a period of tremendous technological advancement. At the time, it was unprecedented for a designer and his team to have such a widespread impact on the public consumer. He took a principled, considered approach to design that we apparently had to relearn in the 21st century with the advent of the internet and the digital age. I first read this book about 10 years ago, and as I've gone back through it, taking copious notes and capturing inspiring quotes, I've regained an appreciation for some of the practical insights and creative mindsets that have influenced me over the years, and reconsidered how I can apply Dreyfuss's knowledge, experience, and spirit to my own work. So before we continue, I just wanted to say a few quick words about the goal and agenda for this episode. This is not meant to be in any way a substitute or replacement for reading the book, The Man in the Brown Suit. My goal is that after hearing about it, that you'll be interested in going out and getting it yourself, reading it, or at least learning more about Henry Dreyfuss in some other way on your own. So what I'm really trying to do here is not recount the book, but just sort of synthesize what I saw, some of the top themes that recurred throughout the book, sort of weave in some anecdotes and quotes and some of my own notes along the way, and then talk about some takeaways, things that I think are relevant, for bringing back into our own work today. So I hope you enjoy it, and I hope you get something out of it. Okay, so let's jump into the top three themes that stood out to me going back through this book. They're Dreyfuss's view on the role of the designer, his philosophy of design overall, and his view on commercialism. In Dreyfuss's role-defining work, we see the emergence of the concept of human-centered design that we have today, where the role of the designer is to advocate for the person using the product and consider the full context of that experience. So even when working on things like machines early on, or more, kind of industrial things, railroads, trains, automobiles, vehicles, communication technology, we see the quote here: there is something else that industrial designers contributed that engineers had not concerned themselves with, an appreciation that the proper mental state of a machine's operator is as much an aspect of functionalism as is the layout and structure of the mechanism itself. So this is great because we see here, even early on, there's this idea that it's not just about the product and designing the right controls and labels and things like that. You also have to factor in the person who is operating this thing and that is a core part of considering that functional design. It goes beyond the idea of designer as stylist. You have these user-centered considerations of things like legibility, placement of controls, forms giving reassurances of stability and safety. So these are design aspects that contribute to that overall user experience. And Dreyfus really saw this as core to how he considered the success of a design. So in measuring success, Dreyfus was writing in Industrial Magazine, "We bear in mind that the object being worked on is going to be ridden in, sat upon, looked at, talked into, activated, operated, or in some other way used by people. When the point of contact between the product and the people becomes a point of friction, then the designer has failed. On the other hand, if people are made safer, more efficient, more comfortable, or just plain happier by contact with the product, then the designer has succeeded." So again, there is a core aspect of design being measured by that user experience and what somebody gets out of it. And there's some great examples here, great stories in the book around the work with Polaroid. The Dreyfus firm was instrumental in work on the Automatic 100 Land camera. This was obviously a collaboration. So you had the film, optics, electronics technology. That was all handled by Polaroid and their engineers. But the Dreyfus firm, they focused on actual use by humans, making buttons, levers discernible, making things easy to use, arranging components within the device to reduce size, using lighter, more robust materials, and thinking about that real-world usage. Okay, so we have this film pack that enables people to develop photographs outside of the camera, which you couldn't do before. But the question is, so you've got this light camera people can just carry around with them, throw it over their shoulder. What are they going to do with that film? Where do they put it while it's developing? They created these charts, these kind of storyboard user flows, cartoon-like drawings of thinking through and visualizing that experience. How is somebody actually going to use this camera? They really worked to make that technology accessible to the mass market by designing for this end-to-end user experience. Also, in their work on the SX70 camera, there was a quote in here that this was considered a crowning achievement that may well have been the most ambitious, successful development program in the Polaroid Corporation's history. So in looking at the author's examination of the contributions of the Dreyfus firm to the success, I love this quote. It says, "Such niceties might not be anticipated by engineers oriented most strongly toward technical feasibility and cost reduction, but they were essential in ensuring the success of a consumer product." There's another great quote here by a Dreyfus associate talking about Edwin Land, a co-founder of Polaroid. He said, "Land liked Henry because Henry didn't know what you couldn't do." And I love this quote because it's an example of designer as sort of visionary, you know, greenfield thinker, divergent thinker, coming up with crazy ideas. This is a really important part of the creative process that we can see Dreyfus establishing early and as being, you know, one of the reasons for his success with so many different products and so many different companies. So one of his colleagues talking about how they would collaborate in these think tank sessions, Dreyfus would throw out 100 ideas. Maybe 97 of them were no good, but 3 of them would be the best. And Henry insisted you couldn't get those 3 without the other 97. So the next aspect of this theme, role of the designer, that I want to talk about is seeing the designer on equal footing with others on the team. This idea of a level of equality. So the quote here is, "The conditions he set, working on a level of equality with the manufacturer and its employees, and collaborating on designs rather than serving as an aesthetic consultant, turned out to be among the most important in his early career." This was a really critical expectation that he set early on, and he would just flat out turn down work if he was either told or sensed that he wouldn't be able to work, say, directly with the engineers who would be building the product. So he understood the importance of that early on and really built his practice around that idea. In talking about, you know, sort of building on the success of industrial design in general in the 30s, the author writes, industrial design had proven its worth in addressing not just sales appeal, but improved function. So we start to see that designers are playing a more active role in the products themselves and not just sort of coming in as an afterthought. So Dreyfus really did a lot to define the integrity of this role. And there was a little bit of an adversarial element in his approach. Someone asked Dreyfus, you know, what are you thinking about before you go into, say, like a pitch? And he actually says, he walks in thinking to himself, you bastards. So I don't think that I would necessarily take, you know, that mindset today. But I think what he's getting at here is, you know, not to be combative. I mean, he actually worked very well with many people and almost everyone liked working with him. But he understood that there were some differences in motivations and drivers among the different people in the room that he would be trying to convince. It says here, you know, he knew that many considered what he had to offer them a luxury. You know, he's going in knowing that some people might be thinking, you know, this is a nice to have. And he wanted to stand his ground. He understood that this work was integral and essential. And so he wanted to make sure he advocated for that in establishing the working relationships with the clients. Lastly, on this theme, I wanted to talk about aesthetics, but in the context of enduring and timeless design. Although we've been talking so far about the role of the designer going beyond aesthetic consultant, shaping the aesthetics is still an important piece. And this was one of my favorite quotes in the book, page 140. This is talking about some of the early work with Honeywell. He writes, Dreyfus's designers were soon generating guides to camber and radius treatments for box type covers for industrial components, giving them a look of quality that did away with the sheet metal aesthetic of the engineer. So, yes, you can throw something together and you can, you know, slap some rivets in some sheet metal and get something out there. But with somebody like Dreyfus and his contemporaries, you know, they were looking to kind of elevate the quality, the experience, even with industrial products or kind of, you know, mundane household products. They wanted them to sort of exude quality. And so the aesthetics were a part of that. And they were starting to get more involved in describing and kind of annotating what needed to happen in the manufacture of these products. Also, Dreyfus was, so while these aesthetics are important, one thing that he was not very keen on was this idea of style in the sense of seasonal style or following trends. And he was very opposed to the idea of planned obsolescence. It says here, Dreyfus hoped his designs would be outmoded not by stylistic shifts in interior decoration and popular taste, but by technological obsolescence. So he was really thinking about design as, you know, creating enduring products, timeless products, things that would last and things that would not just go out of style because of changing tastes, but that would go out of style because the technology had literally moved on and gone to a whole nother level. In his own words, Dreyfus said, "We say that a design expresses the excellence of its engineers and reflects the integrity of its manufacturer. That hardly suggests a seasonal change, We industrial designers are not in the business of style or fashion. Ours is a basic approach. Our designing must be generic by nature. If the most contemporary of design can be called classic, then call us classicists. And even some of his rivals or critics, you know, people who kind of took a different view, one of these people was George Nelson. Nelson was a writer and director of design at Herman Miller. He was a modernist and a Bauhaus advocate. So very functionalist, rational, bare minimum design. He criticized Dreyfus and some of his work at the time, but later acknowledged his success, writing, "His products, his designs, quote, stood up very, very well, quite hard after 10 years to figure out what you would do that would be any better. He never really fooled around. Very, very solid." This is just an amazing accolade to think about nowadays. Can you just imagine in the context of software or some other digital design, coming up with something that after 10 years would be hard to figure out how to improve? That just seems pretty incredible nowadays. So for this theme, the role of the designer, just kind of reviewing here, human-centered user advocate. Okay, so that's our job as designers, primarily. We want to make sure that we're kind of seen on equal footing with others on the team. So product, engineering, sales, marketing, it's important to be an equal voice among that whole team. And then thinking about aesthetics in the context of enduring and timeless design. For the next theme, the philosophy. So here I want to get into some of Dreyfus's actual sort of philosophy of design. It overlaps a little bit with some of the stuff we talked about in role, but this gets kind of more into the nuts and bolts of how he thought about design and sort of how he approached the methodology. Early on, the author talks about that Dreyfus established these kind of tenets of his design in the 1930s. So those were utility without sparseness, attention to detail, and emphasis on human use. These basic tenets evolved into what he called the 5 points later on, but good to note here early on, there's still that emphasis on human use, even from the very beginning. So later, getting into the 5 points, at this time, he established this core philosophy. And he would, you know, use this with clients, with his team. He would illustrate it. So these 5 points were: number one, safety and convenience of use. Number two, ease of maintenance. Number three, cost. Number four, appeal. Number five, appearance. Flincham writes, it was their prioritization that made his designs exceptional, that they were centered on human, not abstract values. Dreyfus, in his words, noted, they are usually a surprise to manufacturers. They are amazed about it because so many people feel that we are just interested in what a product looks like. So again, this helped to reinforce his ideas of that role of the designer. And they made it very, he made it very visual. In fact, one of his colleagues talked about how Dreyfus really liked that it was 5 things because he could draw a hand, you know, up on the board or whatever and list them out there and sort of make it very clear about what his expectations were. People are the focus here. And there's a nice quote here, says, as with his product design, people were the focus of Dreyfus's concern, their comfort, their convenience, their safety, and their inherent sense of good taste. And I brought this one in because there's a couple takes on the idea of taste here and the view of the public on taste. Not everyone shared Dreyfus's view that the public had an inherent sense of good taste. Max Bill, a Swiss designer very much in the modernist camp, he's quoted in here as writing, the persistent cultivation of this myth of public taste is the unhappy hunting ground of unscrupulous manufacturers and middlemen who employ all the resources of publicity to persuade the consumer that the myth is reality. So a pretty dim view on the view of the public and, you know, what they know about design or how well they can sort of make choices about design. Bill represents the view that designers are really the arbiters of taste. They decide what's good, and they tell you what's good by what they make and display, and the public's supposed to learn from that. Whereas Dreyfuss, on the other hand, he felt that most people have inherent good taste, but they can't be expected to use it if they can't find good things. And so Dreyfuss felt that on the whole, people had a good sense of design, but there was just a lot of poorly designed products out there that made it hard for people to kind of do the right thing. There was a funny anecdote early on where Dreyfuss was given the opportunity to do some work with Macy's, and they basically asked him to just come in. They asked him to just, you know, wander around. He could go to any department, any floor, and redesign anything he didn't like. Well, he didn't see much that he did like. He basically disliked everything. He felt that people needed to be given better choices and that they would be able to exercise their good taste. So the next aspect of his philosophy I want to talk about is participation and what we might call today participatory design. So he was very big on this idea of a roundtable approach, and this included both working with clients and working, you know, internally at his firm. On the client side, he stressed having all division heads involved in early discussions and brainstorming. In the office, he involved designers and non-designers in these think tank sessions. He saw these outside perspectives as critical to the design process. He was not big on this idea of sort of the lone genius designer going off in a corner and coming up with all the ideas. Very involved, wanting all the stakeholders involved when they were initially setting out on a project, and then wanting a lot of different viewpoints involved on the design side. So another aspect of participation and sort of hands-on design was that Dreyfuss was big on learning how to use the things that he designed. So he did a lot of different work for a lot of different companies and, you know, many different products, a really wide range that I think would, you know, surprise a lot of designers today, where we tend to kind of be more narrowly focused. But so he wanted to learn these things. And my take on this is that he was doing this as a way to, you know, validate direction, to build empathy for the people that he was designing for. So it was not to, you know, design something in the way that he would want it to be used. I think he, as much as possible, you know, considered the context of the people. He designed for that. And then he wanted to sort of validate that those were good decisions. And so when he was doing work for Singer on sewing machines, he would take classes on how to sew. When he was working on tractors for John Deere, he would learn how to operate a tractor. He would learn typing for Royal typewriters. And he also did some work for the military. So he would even learn how to like operate a tank and that sort of thing. So yeah, very hands-on, multiple people, multiple perspectives, users, and himself sort of all collaborating together on making good designs. So we talked about human-centeredness in the role of the designer, but in terms of the core aspect of the philosophy, there was really interesting work done by Dreyfuss and his team on anthropometry. So that is the scientific study of the measurements and proportions of the human body. This was helpful in a number of ways. Not the least of which was as a sales tool. So it was pretty impressive for clients for them to be able to pull out these drawings of very detailed measurements showing lengths, proportion, range of motion of the human body. And they had these sort of, you know, personas, these kind of characters, Joe and Josephine, I think it is. You know, that would impress clients by seeming to take the guesswork out of the design process. It was sort of this pseudo-scientific approach. And a lot of this came out of the military, you know, during World War II. I think it was work done mainly around pilots and, you know, just trying to figure out, like, how do we build these machines in a way that makes them usable by people in these very high stress situations? You know, how do we minimize the risk of things going really badly? And so that's kind of where it started. And eventually it evolved into the field that we have today called human factors. But Dreyfus had access to some of this work from the military, and then his firm built on it and published it. It really was the first example of this work being available more broadly to the public. On the one hand, there was a little bit of risk there because it could come across as being, you know, very scientific, but really these charts were used for designers in these kind of preliminary investigations. So I sort of see it as similar to the kind of gut checking of designs that we do with usability testing or even hallway testing. These are not tools to provide certainty. They're mainly for increasing confidence that you're on the right track and you're not going to be, you know, blindsided by something that was just invisible to you but obvious to others. So having these kind of tools helped them sort of gut check their designs before they would go too far down a wrong path. There's a great quote here in the context of this work, Measure of Man. Dreyfus really saw their role as fitting the machine to the man rather than the man to the machine. And that was certainly a different view, and it was counter to what had been happening, where, you know, there were cost concerns, there were construction concerns. Somebody would decide to build something that they thought they needed, and they would do it in the best way they could figure out how to do it. And then, you know, people would have to be trained, people would have to figure out how to use it and sort of adapt. But Dreyfus kind of flipped that view on its head and said, no, we need to fit these machines around the people and design around the people. And so the last thing I wanted to mention on the philosophy here, and this will segue into the next theme of commercialism, there was a great anecdote here where Dreyfus was in a meeting with representatives from the Museum of Modern Art. They were interested in doing a one-man exhibit of his work. And they, you know, they started talking about it. Eventually it kind of got into them sort of, you know, asking questions, maybe giving a little bit of critique here and there. I'll just read from this passage here and you can see where it goes. One of the representatives from MoMA said, "The numerals on this clock dial seem out of proportion." Another asked, "Why did you put that chrome on the bottom of the typewriter?" Rather than try to explain, I suggested that we forget the idea of an exhibit. It occurred to me that the only museums in which I care to show my work are places like Macy's, Marshall Field's, and the May Company. So I love this because it's a great example of how what was important to Dreyfus was not coming up with some beautifully designed product that was just made to be put on a shelf or in an exhibit and admired for its own existence. For him, the culmination of a design was its usage and really going through that entire process of being built, being packaged, being shipped, being marketed, and being sold, and then ultimately used by the person, you know, who it was designed for. That is what was important to Dreyfus as a designer. And again, going back to how you measure, you know, how he thought about measuring success was how it made that person feel and how it helped them accomplish something. So for the last theme, I did want to talk about commercialism. You know, it has kind of a negative connotation nowadays, but Dreyfus's views and work were really rooted in this kind of pragmatism. As I was just saying, you know, he was designing things for people to use. So let's look at a few examples. Earlier, I mentioned he had the opportunity to work with Macy's and go through the store and just sort of redesign any product he didn't like. I didn't get into the quote there, so I'm going to read that now. He also felt that the big idea had one important defect. It overlooked the fact that a manufacturer could seldom change the design of a product without scrapping valuable machinery and retooling his plant at great expense. It was useless, according to Dreyfus, for a retailer to bombard manufacturers with random suggestions. He did not see design as, let's make a bunch of suggestions, tell these companies what's wrong with their products. He knew that wasn't going to fly. And so for him, this was a fruitless way to approach design. He was very practical and wanted to be in the process with the people who were going to be building the thing, who were going to be marketing and selling the thing. So it really had to be a total engagement and not just this aesthetic consultant engagement. He worked on designing this whole sort of new train line for the New York Central Railroad called the Mercury Line. There was a great part of the story here where, you know, they came up with all these amazing ideas. They were going to make this really high-end train. And the plan, it was almost scrapped because, at, you know, they got to a point where they just realized, like, this is going to be too expensive. Like, for us to do this from the ground up, it's just going to cost too much and we don't think it's feasible. So Dreyfus, he was actually heading out of town. So he was taking a train out of New York. He was just like, I just need to get a break, get away from this. On the way out, he noticed that there were a bunch of unused commuter cars and proposed reusing them as a starting point to cut costs. And this actually saved the project. Later, this Mercury Line was, quote, widely heralded as a breakthrough in travel. So again, while the designer has a important role to play in, you know, thinking big, thinking visionary ideas, you don't want to just live there. You also have to consider, how is this thing going to get done? Because if you don't factor that in, it might not get done. And if, you know, this idea, if he didn't come back with this approach, maybe this project wouldn't have happened. One of his contemporaries was a man named Norman Bel Geddes. He was also a kind of mentor for Dreyfus. Dreyfus worked for him at some point when they were in theater design. Henry learned a lot from him, but he also kind of learned how to sort of differentiate himself. So he saw Norman Bel Geddes as this kind of genius futurist who had, you know, amazing ideas, but he also saw that not many of his ideas came to fruition. So I think this had a big influence on Dreyfus, quote, staying in the realm of the achievable. He wanted to do amazing things at scale, but he wanted to see them happen. Dreyfus, at one point, he was writing about some recommendations to a bus transportation company. And so this bus company was, you know, basically trying to figure out, you know, why are sales dropping? We need to get more people kind of interested in riding the bus again. And so Dreyfus was writing about, you know, how the role of design is an important part of actually creating this consumer appeal. Again, one of his 5 points, thinking about the appeal, essentially the product market fit. He wrote, being of proven value, design is growing, broadening, permeating other fields in which it has not before been tried. It is now tackling more extensive and more complicated problems. Even at this time, back in the, you know, this would have been the 40s maybe, design is sort of maturing and moving into what we would call today service design. And there's this discussion of Dreyfus's view that in the words of the author, he is no longer addressing a product per se, but the packaging of a service. Dreyfus doesn't make the distinction between, quote, the service of transporting people and the marketing of a product. So this really speaks to that increasing scope, increasing domain of design, and really having more people see it as providing value in different ways. Even, again, kind of crossing over into merchandising and continuing this theme of all product design is really service design, which was said by Peter Merholz. I don't want to get sidetracked with that. Look it up. In an article, Dreyfus wrote, "Design is beginning to play a part in the merchandising of such things as railroad tickets, telegrams, gasoline, and business, institutional prestige. Designers are busy using color, form, and materials concretely to help sell such intangibles. The designer must be able to understand merchandising and know how to extract the vital principles involved in the problems. These ideas must be dramatized through visual design so that they are intelligible to the average person." And what I like about this passage is that, again, it reinforces this idea that the designer needs to be involved in this whole sort of product development process and really this whole sales cycle. And as a designer, we really have to understand the product in that context, help people to understand what problem is this solving for you, how it's going to make your life better, and why you should care about this thing. Because again, if they don't know about it, if they don't care, if they don't realize that it's going to help them, it's not going to happen. I mentioned he did some work on trains. There's a quote here: "In designing a train, we not only design the train outside and in, but also every detail and accessory, including the porter's uniforms, matches, magazine covers, china, silver, etc. We feel that if we are designing a product, any detail related to that product is part of the job." And so this illustrates total design, kind of this unified theory of design. And it does make me think of a quote by Massimo Vignelli in his book, The Vignelli Canon. He said, "If you can design one thing, you can design everything." We see that in some of Dreyfus's work, whether it was trains or theaters or later on an entire building. He saw that it was important for the designer to be involved in the total brand manifestation of the company and the product and the service. Again, in terms of commercialism, scale. So now, today, we've got things like the iPhone, and Apple has shipped hundreds of millions of these. At the time, the 60s, well, it sort of started earlier than that, but Dreyfus did work on an earlier phone for Bell. I think it was the 302 that sort of evolved and influenced what was called the 500 series phone. And this was that kind of black rotary dial handset resting in the cradle on top phone. At the time, these were among the quote is, "These units were clearly among the most numerous objects of a technological nature ever shaped by one person's aesthetic." They said by 1965, there were over 7 million units of the Model 500 telephone sold. And so this was kind of the iPhone of the time, where it was this product that had just reached a scale of public usage that just was totally new at this time. And that also leads into the story of the Honeywell Round thermostat. There's a lot in here that I'm not going to get to in a lot of detail, but this was a hugely successful product. Dreyfus was awarded a patent for it. There's a whole interesting backstory to this. There was another design engineer, within Honeywell who played an important role as well. His name was Cronmiller, Carl Cronmiller. He also received a patent for like a different aspect of it. Dreyfus had everything to do with perfecting the design with the engineering department and recommending that the product appear in color in our promotion. The introduction was a smash. It was the design that did the trick. Cronwell was presented an award by Honeywell, but Dreyfus actually appeared in the ads, and his collaboration with Honeywell continued to increase after this success story. So Dreyfus, his name was out there at the time. I mean, even in some early things, he would actually have his signature, you know, on some of the products. But he also was well known enough that he was associated with some of these products and was actually used to market them. But again, we see he was involved in every detail of perfecting that design. So how it was built, how it would be maintained, also thought about how are we going to sell this thing and how are we going to get people to be aware of it. So something that was interesting at the time, I mean, they even thought about things like, okay, you've got all of these big, ugly, rectangular thermostats in everyone's house. So what's going to happen if we sell this thing and they pull off the rectangular thermostat and then they try to put on this round one, this perfectly circular thermostat in its place? You're going to see these like, you know, ugly holes sticking out from the previous one. So they thought about, you know, how to design it, sizing and shape to cover the marks of the previously installed models. And then also the idea that you could remove this cover and you could paint it. And so you could kind of adapt it to the interior design of your home. This was not something that a lot of people did necessarily, but the fact that you could do it was a great marketing take on this. And Dreyfus was adamant that they emphasize that element and actually show the advertisements in color so that you know, people can realize what's possible there. One more quote on the round. This is from a passage here. The design process is rarely linear, and many product designs resulted from the desires of marketing and sales departments. Nonetheless, it seems that Henry Dreyfus's role was critical in the success of the round. He enjoyed the esteem of Honeywell's management as well as its staff, and this new piece of apparatus illustrates perfectly his concept of the role of design in society. I have a link here. There's a great YouTube video. It's called Classic Honeywell Round Thermostat Teardown. So I'll share the link, but it's a look at this, you know, original, one of the original items, and just how impressive just the design, the engineering, everything about it is, and how it's lasted so long and sort of continues to influence the design of products today. So to wrap up our discussion on these themes, we see that, one, Dreyfus saw the role of the designer as one that is people-focused and plays an important and equal part with others in making successful, lasting products. Two, while his design philosophy was human-centered and participatory, it was also considerate of real-world constraints. And three, his design practice was rooted in a pragmatism that valued commercial success as the culmination of meaningful work. So in terms of taking some of this inspiration back into my own work, these are some of the things that I'll be thinking about after reading this book, The Man in the Brown Suit. First, go beyond the role of aesthetic consultant. As a designer, you want to make sure you're in the right conversations about what you're building and why. Don't just sort of sit back and wait for the work to come to you. Be a proactive participant. Also, think about how you're measuring success. For me and many other designers working in the area of enterprise software, this can be challenging when the buyer is not the user. So when you have that separation, you know, the people who are deciding whether or not to purchase your product that leads to that commercial success, they aren't necessarily the right people to be evaluating, you know, how that product works in context in the real world. That is going to be something that comes from the end users, and sometimes it's hard to reach those people. Another thing is you want to trust the creative process. So we heard in those think tank sessions that happened at Dreyfus's firm where, you know, quantity leads to quality. And this has been reiterated many times by different people, particularly the IDEO group and in the work that they've done to sort of popularize design thinking and their rules for brainstorming. You want to be suspicious of landing on the obvious solution too early. You want to make sure you're stretching yourself and your team to really come up with some creative solutions that you might not otherwise get to if you stop too soon. And above all, we want to keep the focus on the people, right? As Dreyfus said, if people are made safer, more efficient, more comfortable, or just plain happier, then the designer has succeeded.